And welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Mike King from TomatoBubble.com, and we're going to pick up here and change gears a bit, change the topic, and talk a little bit more about the Hitler in Argentina hoax. Mike had a good piece up on this on his website short while ago, and I know that he has a completely different take on this story. We've actually talked with some of the people in the past about the Argentina possibility, including the author of Grey Wolf, and we did talk with Harry Cooper, etc., but I want to hear what you have to say about this, Mike, because it's one of those things that kind of, it's caught on pretty well, actually, and it's kind of lurked its way into the mainstream, more or less, I think, and specifically when Grey Wolf was released, that was picked up by a lot of mainstream, you know, media sources, and I believe the book has been doing very well as well. Basically, anything with, you know, Nazis and Hitler is as like tops. I mean, look at all the documentaries and stuff that's been out in the last, you know, 20, 30 years about all kinds of interesting things. But tell us about the how you approach the Argentina story.
Well, certainly the name Hitler is definitely A-list Hollywood stuff. You put his name on anything and it'll sell. And just recently, Jerome Corsi, who's very well known, just last month, he joined the parade. He came up with Hunting Hitler, in which he boasts of scientific evidence. So this genre has been around a while and has definitely gained in momentum. And I've had many readers write to me over this past year or so saying, hey, did you know Hitler was Argentina? Have you read this book, this and that? And, you know, initially I didn't even want to take a look at it because, you know, I knew the details of the suicide story, and they were quite convincing. So this was something I dismissed out of hand. But, you know, it's gotten to the point where it's so entrenched. I said, you know, I need to take a look at this with an open mind. And I will tell you, although I had a preconceived notion and a bias against it, I do have that philosophical ability to put that aside and just be totally objective. And I can honestly say I took an objective look at this stuff. And it was a part of me that was almost hoping that it was true, thinking, you know, at least Hitler got to live out some kind of a peaceful life. But I see nothing here but logical fallacies and hearsay and conjecture and all of this talk about documentation and forensic evidence. As soon as you get into it with a really critical eye of an investigator, it falls apart. I see nothing here, not even a valid hypothesis. And I decided to write this piece. I call it The Hitler in Argentina Hoax. And, you know, I just go through it. And one of the things, there's five books in particular that I focus on. And one of the things I noticed about all of them was the degree of boasting that either the authors or their publicists make about the book. Quotes such as absolute proof, DNA evidence, scientific evidence, compelling testimony, powerful case, magisterial study, so on and so on. It's a lot of hype. But when you get into it, there's not only nothing there at all. I don't know. I don't want to pass judgment on people's character. I don't know if this is shoddy research, or some of these people were just out to make a buck, but I the whole thing to me is an absolute fraud, and I will give you my reasons, just as I did in the piece.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Let's go through it here. There's, of course, certain things that they do, you know, bring to the table, and it seems certain things are kind of coming up again and again throughout, you know, some of the books at least. So yeah, let's just kind of go through some of it then.
Well, let's start with the story that we, you know, the official story. And I point out before I get into this that just because establishment historians are a bunch of liars and propagandists for the most part, it doesn't mean that everything is a lie. You still have to look at every event with a critical eye and apply the rules of evidence.
So okay, let's hold it right there. I just want to emphasize that because I think that's a really good it's a really good point because it's easy to get carried away. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the conspiracy industry that has arisen in the last few years is in many cases built on this idea that everything is fake all the time, right? And I mean, even look at, I mean, there, and there are things that are fake. There are false flags. There are things that occur. They're not real. There's, you know, major questions around events like, you know, Sandy Hook and whatever, but it's kind of turned into this automatic knee-jerk reaction that whatever happens, it has to be fake, you know, or it's like actors are involved in everything, or it's nothing at all. And this is frankly not constructive to the purposes of what we're trying to achieve here, which is to get to the truth of the matter, right? So I think that what you said there is really important. And just because, you know, it comes from the mainstream media, or even if it's said by someone who's an official professor at some university or what have you, it doesn't mean that it's all complete lies every single time. And yes, I understand it's tricky to end up in that kind of position of being a contrarian all the time kind of thing. So I think what you said is worth emphasizing and worth to keep in mind. But yeah, please go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, heck, you know, even bloody Karl Marx got a few things right. I mean, you know, broken clocks are right twice a day. So always, right. no matter what, I never assume anything. So we can't assume that establishment historians are wrong on everything. So we go back to the suicide in the Berlin bunker. And to me, there are three main types of evidence that make any case: documentary, forensic, and of course, witnesses. And I apply those three standards to each of the theories, the Berlin suicide and the Argentina escape. So we start with the bunker in Berlin. Do we have documentary evidence? Well, we have a document that nobody has questioned, and that is Hitler's suicide note, or the final testament, as he calls it. And I will quote from you the pertinent line here. Okay. I should like, by remaining in this town, to share my fate with those, the millions of others, who have also taken upon themselves to do so. Moreover, I do not wish to fall into the hands of an enemy who requires a new spectacle organized by the Jews for the amusement of their hysterical masses. I have decided, therefore, to remain in Berlin, and there, of my own free will, to choose death at the moment when I believe the position of the Führer and Chancellor itself can no longer be held. I die with a happy heart, aware of the immeasurable deeds and achievements of our soldiers at our front, our women at home, et cetera, et cetera. Okay?
Right.
This is an incontestable document. Nobody contests it. It was typed out. Jungi only died a few years ago. Okay? So that is documentary evidence.
Sorry, but back up there, Mike. We lost your connection. Who typed it out, you said?
Oh, Trottel Jungi.
Okay, thank you.
Jungi. She was the young secretary of Hitler, and she only died a few years ago. I think she passed away like 2002 or 2003. Okay, so nobody questions this document. Not even the contrarians. So that's documentary evidence. Now one can say, well, yeah, that was part of the scam. All right, but we'll get to that later. The point is, this is a point of documentation. So that's one. Now we go to the eyewitnesses who were in that bunker. There are many of them, and they were cross-examined, by some by Soviets, some by Americans, and many of them, I point out, died only recently, and they stayed true to the story of the suicide in the bunker. Hitler's bodyguard, Rolke Misch, he died only last year in 2013. There's the secretary, Trottel Jungi, that we talked about. There is Eric Kempke, Otto Gunschke. I mean, you can see all the names. I researched this in detail, and I even learned some more things about the suicide account that I didn't know. So they go into detail. Hitler's personal bodyguard, the gentleman only died last year, and right up until the very end, he was unapologetic, okay? Defended Hitler, and of course never changed his story. But he said, quote, "I saw Hitler slumped with his head on the table. I saw Eva Braun sitting dead in the corner of the sofa, her head turned to Hitler, her knees pulled up to her chest. She had a dark blue dress on, etc." Otto Gunschke, who was Hitler's personal assistant, he stood guard as Hitler committed suicide. And he also died not too long ago. And he wrote, quote, "The Russian troops were only a few hundred meters from the walls of the chancellery and could storm the garden at any moment. So carrying the bodies into the garden and the immediate preparations for cremations had to be done in great haste." And then there's the secretary who typed out the final testament. Again, Trotald Jungi. "Suddenly there was a sound of a shot, so loud, so close, we all fell silent. It echoes on through the rooms. That was a direct hit," cried Helmut Goebbels, with no idea how right he was. "The Führer is dead now." These people told the same story for decades. Some of them were on TV shows in later years. I have pictures of them when they were elderly. There were also other bodyguards. I mean, you have a whole bunch of people there who survived, who got out. They were either captured by the Americans when they fled west. Some were captured by the Soviets. Fortunately, they were not murdered, but they all told the same story, and they never changed. And we're expected to believe that they were all duped, okay?
Right.
Well, again, we'll get into that later. The point is, do we have eyewitness evidence to go along with the documentary? And the answer, again, is yes. So that's 2 out of 2. Now we go on to the forensic evidence. And this was something that I discovered. I didn't know this. I didn't even know about this. During the 1970s, a world-renowned dental expert, he's a Norwegian. His name was Dr. Reidar Sognianis, who founded the dental school at UCLA, actually. On his own initiative, he compared the known dental records of Adolf Hitler, which were had been obtained by his from his dentist, by the Americans, and he compared that to the Soviet autopsy resort. And Hitler had such elaborate bridge work. And you know, when you analyze dental work, that's as good as fingerprints or DNA.
Right.
And this was a peer-reviewed study, and he had a partner with it, and they published this. I mean, this is a done deal. It's 100% match. Again, someone could argue, well, it was a big cover-up. This guy is part of it. But I mean, it just doesn't sound plausible. So, I mean, there you have it. The three big forms of evidence, documentary, eyewitness, and forensic, they all exist in abundance. And I've got it all sourced at the piece at tomatobubble.com, which, you know, hopefully you'll host soon, where you can see it at the updates page. And you can read the actual report. I link up to the report, which was issued in the 1970s. So,
right.
That is what I call the Argentinist school. They have to there's a lot that they have to debunk there. Okay? There's no question. Now when we get into the to their version of events and to see what it is that they bring forth to counter all of this evidence, it basically just amounts to, well, it was a big cover-up.
Well, there's the skull and all that, right? We'll get to that later.
You can't just say those things, you know? Now, all of these authors expect us to believe, with the exception of Cooper, and I'll get into that separately, they expect us to believe that Hitler, who even his own critics acknowledge was a man of unusual courage, this is a man who volunteered for World War I. He couldn't get into the Austrian military because he had some problems with tuberculosis when he was younger. So then he volunteers for the German military. He's wounded. He's sent back home to recover. Rather than stay home, he goes back again. He's wounded again. He received 2 Iron Crosses. I mean, you just can't get any more, for lack of a better word, fanatical than this guy. There is no fear in him. So to suggest at the last moment, he just made this scam and he abandoned his inner circle and bailed out. You know, anybody who knows anything at all about his courage, right there, I mean, the story is impossible.
He's kind of, I guess, like a captain that wanted to go down with this ship, right? He didn't squeeze the women and the children to the side to get on the life raft. You know?
Exactly. I mean, he would conduct this enormous ruse on his own personal secretary and his friends and the Goebbels family who killed themselves. And in the end, he's just cutting out the back door using a body double. That's ludicrous. That is impossible. Now, the way that Harry Cooper gets around this problem, and he's the only author of the Big Five who attempts this, is he makes the claim that Martin Bormann orchestrated the escape by slipping Hitler a phony poison or something that just knocked him out but didn't kill him. I mean, what a claim is that? What evidence do you bring forth for that? Again, I mean, there's none. It's just a speculation. How do I fill in this hole? Well, it must have been Bormann putting him to sleep instead of killing him. And then they burned the body double or something like that. So it's just not plausible. There's nothing at all to debunk any of the official story. So what does that leave us? Well, I quote Sherlock Holmes. I said, it is a capital mistake to theorize before one has the data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. And that's what all the Argentinians do, the Argentinists do. They start with the conclusion and they work backwards. They say, well, he escaped to Argentina and this is how he may have done it. He might have duped this one here, or might have been a phony poison here, a body double here. You can't do that. You gather the data and then you look for a pattern. Okay?
Right.
Oh. Yep. So then we arrive at the point now. If all of the evidence for the Berlin suicide remains intact, and it is, the only other way to prove the Argentina theory is in the positive aspect. What I mean by that is they have to present something, evidence that he lived in Argentina and he escaped there, evidence that is so overwhelming and so powerful that, you know, it renders the suicide scenario a moot point, you see?
Right.
So let's have a look at that, applying the same standards, the theory number two, which is Hitler escaped to Argentina. Let's look at the documentary evidence, the witness evidence, and the forensic evidence, which they claim to have. And they claim that in bold headlines and a lot of hype. Well, as you get into it, Henrik, we look at the documentary evidence. I'll give you one example here. They pull up an old newspaper article from the 40s. And here's the headline. Hitler in South America. Well, that's not documentation. Okay, and I'll explain why. Because we read the first couple sentences, look what the article says. This is Anatoly Pulagin, foreign correspondent for TASS. That's the official Soviet news agency. Okay, same crowd that gave us the gas chambers myth.
Right.
They have quoted an unnamed source as stating that Hitler may have flown to South America. So you have a communist propaganda official quoting an unnamed source saying maybe he went to South America, and the newspaper just reports on that. The only thing they're documenting is what Pulagin said. They're not documenting what Hitler did. So that is not documentation. The article continues. The report follows recent rumors that Hitler did not, as previously believed, die in Berlin. So to reprint the fact that somebody said this and somebody said that, that is not documentation. True documentation is something hard and tangible from a first party, like Hitler dictating his own suicide note and Trotto Youngle typing it out. So this is not documentation at all. Then we look at some of the FBI documentation that these authors boast about. And they produce these old FBI documents that talk about the possibility of Hitler escaping to Argentina. And when you look at it superficially, Henrik, it looks impressive. You see a letterhead, Federal Bureau of Investigation. But you've got to dig into it and read the actual quote-unquote documentation. Now, I'm quoting now from the Daily Express of England, which did an article a few years back on this FBI documentation. And here's what we learned from the Express. Quote, "The astonishing documents detail how an Argentinian fugitive claimed he helped Hitler. Again, he said, she said. Two women and other Germans disembark from a submarine in a South American country approximately 2.5 weeks after the fall of Berlin." Okay?
Yeah.
So it's someone else saying it. But then it goes on. Listen to this. "The Argentinian informant who gave the information over to the U.S. authorities, hoping to get asylum in return, is not named in the papers. So we have an unnamed rumor monger who's looking to escape Argentina. At the time was, I guess you would call, quote-unquote, fascist country. So presumably this guy's a Marxist, needs to get out of there. And he's saying to the FBI, hey, I want to come to America. Will you let me in? And if you do, I know where Hitler is. So they're not documenting any escape. They're documenting the fact that someone made this claim, which means it means nothing at all. Okay? And the article goes on to say that there were other FBI documents of tip-offs of people contacting the Bureau and saying they had information that Hitler was living in New York City without his mustache. Right. There were other people called... there were other people called the FBI, said, no, he's in Switzerland. And these are all documented as well. Because you see, if you go, and I make the analogy here, that if I were to go to the FBI and say that Mickey Mouse is plotting to blow up the Empire State Building,
right?
Okay, they have to, quote unquote, document my claim. And that will be there for all posterity. Mm. All it is a documentation of somebody spreading the rumor. It is not a documentation of Hitler escaping to South America.
Right.
But if you just take the superficial look at the document, it's easy to see how one, especially somebody who's predisposed to not wanting to believe anything that the establishment historians say, it's easy to see how you get sucked in.
Right.
Here's another document reproduced by Harry Cooper in his book. Again, impressive letterhead, office memorandum, United States government. You know, like Solzhenitsyn said, he said the great mental disease of the 20th century is superficiality and hastiness. You can't just look at a headline. You've got to dig in. And when we dig into this document that Cooper presents, we read the following. Quote, the following information was brought to the attention of the Los Angeles field office by, name redacted, who advised that the information was originally received by an individual on the name redacted. So in other words, this informant heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend, et cetera, et cetera, and then went to the agency. So again, it is hearsay put into writing. That is not documentation. Understand?
Mm.
And any judge would laugh something out of court like that.
Right.
Here's another bit of documentation from the newcomer to this genre, Jerome Corsi, the notorious neocon. He has a document, a government document, and you read it. It says right in the center, newsmen have also reported the following rumors. It goes on and on and on. So, in other words, you have an official document documenting the fact that newsmen have reported rumors.
Right.
And nothing more.
Yeah. So
newsmen and rumors equals hearsay. And it goes on and on. All the documentation is like this. There's nothing even remotely comparable to something like Hitler's actual final testament, what I call suicide note.
Let's just pause there, and then we'll pick up right there where you want to do. I just wanted to interject something, and I ask you about the what you think might be the psychology behind it, because I think there's a different cases for why this would be. I think, for one, I think that the reasoning behind this is that, well, you know, they're Nazis, right? So you can't trust anything they say. They're always going to be these lying devils that, you know, they're always going to try to trick you and stuff like that. And I think it also, for the some people, it means kind of like that, yes, you know, Darth Vader is still alive, you know, and it heightens the sense that evilness is still in the world, you know, and it has to be fought, right? So maybe there's even a desire to try to, you know, bring this forth to a certain extent and say, yes, it lived on in Argentina, and then, you know, we need to go there, kind of thing, right? But it and all those on the other side of the spectrum, I think maybe they would feel strengthened morals, perhaps, if they find out that, you know, they actually did manage to get out. Maybe there's some, you know, network there. I don't know. There's some other reasonings, perhaps, from a more psychological perspective, of why they would want to see this, you know, occur, basically. What is your take on that? Why would they want to see this happen?
It depends on the individual. I think for, you know, those of us who know the real Hitler, I think some of us, in addition to mistrusting establishment historians, there's a part of us that want to feel, yeah, he made it out. You know what? That poor guy suffered so much. Good for him. he deserved to have a nice life. So maybe that's a part of it. You almost hope that he did get to finally enjoy a little bit of peace and calm. So that's part of it. And as far as the people reading these books who are not of our quote-unquote, you know, Nazi genre, I think a lot of that, while they're predisposed to, you know, the Nazis are the devil, of course, they're capable of anything. Of course, he could have pulled this off. So there's a number of psychological cognitive biases at work here, which can predispose people of different stripes to letting their guard down and not looking at this with the critical eye I have. I mean, I actually read the entire documents that are presented as, you know, ironclad documentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a number of things at work. You know, the human mind is filled with so many odd, you know, little complexes. Even sane people have them, you know.
Sure. Well, everyone. Yeah, exactly. This is just how it is, right? So, okay. Yeah. So let's pick up there again and see what else we need to run through there to talk about the forensic evidence and everything.
Well, okay. So we've established that there's no true documentation. We go into the witnesses here. And I quote Abel Basti, who's one of the original writers of this Argentina school. This is from an interview on an Argentine program. The interviewer asks him, on what basis do you claim Hitler was in Spain after leaving his Berlin bunker? And then Basti replies, quote, I was able to confirm the presence of Hitler in Spain thanks to a now elderly Jesuit priest whose family members were friends of the National Socialist leader. So there's the witness. There is no witness. There's supposedly he has a friend who has a friend who heard it from a friend. That doesn't make a witness, okay? A witness is the people in the bunker who say, I saw the dead body. I was there when they burned the body. That's a true witness. Whether you want to believe that or not, that constitutes witness. This doesn't even meet that standard at all. And even some of the others are mentioned. They're unnamed or they're uncross-examined, which is critical. Because remember, Henrik, you know, when they started putting these researchers on trial for Holocaust denial and they started asking some of the so-called witnesses, they did so poorly on the witness stand that they stopped calling these people. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, well, yeah, I was in Auschwitz, and yeah, I saw the smoke coming out, and that was the bodies burning. Yes, but did you see anyone go into a gas chamber? Did you witness the inside of a gas chamber? Well, no. You see what happens under cross-examine? You find out if somebody is truly a witness or not. There's nobody here who's been cross-examined. It's all third party. And the bottom line, there is no first party eyewitness evidence of Hitler escaping to Argentina. None.
Yeah, so you would say it's a lot of this is due to the fact that they don't want to have any kind of trial scenario about this either, right? Because that would actually that would reveal too much. It's better to keep that whole thing buried than to actually investigate it, right?
Right. Again, there's always an excuse for something. This is back to circular reasoning. You say, well, there's no witnesses have been cross-examined. It's just hearsay. Well, that's because they're afraid to come forward. But again, you know, you could go on with that forever. You cannot put the conclusion first. I have to look at data. There's no cross-examined, you know, witnesses. So,
yep.
You know, hearsay don't cut it. And somebody who said they heard it from a friend or another friend doesn't cut it. And even somebody who might claim, well, yeah, I saw him. He hasn't been cross-examined. That means nothing. Especially in light of the fact that we do know that many Germans made it out.
Right.
And some of them were probably high level, and some of them were probably hiding, and there was a degree of secrecy. So, yeah, it's very easy to imagine how someone could say, you know what, I wonder if that's Hitler up there on that mountain, you know?
Yeah.
So, again, there are no witnesses that would meet any kind of credible standard. Certainly nothing comparable to that whole slew of witnesses who were cross-examined by the Soviets and the Americans. There's no contest.
Right.
You know? Which leads us with forensic evidence.
Right, exactly. And don't let me get you off track here, but I think there was another one here. And you brought this up too in the story, and I think we so far jumped past it, right? But it was the picture, as you said there, that he married Adolf Hitler lived to 95 with his Brazilian lover. He married a black woman. And it was, who was the one who released that information again?
That woman's name was Diaz.
Diaz, that's right, yeah.
She was a Brazilian Jew. You know, I didn't even spend much time on her because, her accusations are so ridiculous. But of course, she did say that she's totally convinced.
Right, so we got to take her word for it, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that photo is funny that they released. I'm looking at it on the Daily Mail right now. It's kind of a fun photo, actually.
Yeah, it's Hitler with a black woman who's at least a good 6 inches taller than him. So anyway, we don't have real eyewitnesses, and we do not have documentary evidence. Well, is there any forensic evidence? Jerome Corsi says he has scientific evidence. Again, when you dig into his claim, supposedly a fragment of a skull that was, I don't know, in a Russian museum or something like that, or supposed to have been Hitler's, was analyzed, and they say it belongs to a woman. Well, that's not DNA evidence of Hitler escaping to Argentina. That's just evidence that this skull you're looking at, you know, might have belonged to a woman. How do you make such conjecture? So if this fragment doesn't add up, you know, maybe the wrong fragment was analyzed. Or maybe Eva Braun's got mixed in, or maybe it was taken from the wrong sample. Or maybe the Soviets were still playing games with this because they did give conflicting accounts.
Oh, so, certainly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's an important thing to remember as well in all of this, that it's like people, obviously when you're left with nothing, you take what you can, but it doesn't mean that the source is good or going to tell you the whole story there. And as we know, the Soviets, they made so many, you know, false claims and made so much stuff up that, you know, what can we believe about this, you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, these are the same people that told us that the massacre at Caton Forest was carried out by the Germans when it was them. Right. These are the same people who told us about the gas chambers of Auschwitz. And you know, they definitively said that they had Hitler's body. And then on other occasions, they said, well, maybe we don't. So, you know, the Argentinists are cherry picking the ambiguous comments, and they ignore the definitive ones. But ultimately, the most credible witnesses of all won't be the Argentinists or even the Soviets, but all those Germans were in the bunker. And then, of course, I go back to, and I point out that Corsi is so hung up on DNA evidence, he doesn't even address the results of that Norwegian dental expert. Okay?
Right.
So he ignores the peer-reviewed 100% forensic match between Hitler's American-held dental records and the Russian autopsy results.
Yeah.
So much for Corsi's DNA evidence, you know? But, you know, again, if people are predisposed, they hear the word DNA and they say, oh, DNA. Oh, okay, it's proven, but it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's another bit of forensic evidence, which is photographic evidence, which is published on the back of Cooper's book. It's a picture of what purports to be an elderly Hitler with a rag over his head. He looks like, I don't know, he looks like he's pushing 80 years old. And then the caption underneath is just astonishing. Here's what the caption reads underneath. Photo on the right, surfaced online, apparently shows Hitler near the end of his life. And I key in on that, surfaced online. I mean, are you kidding me? You know, with a little bit of Photoshop, I point out in the article, I could bring Julius Caesar or Abe Lincoln back to life. You know, I've even seen pictures of Michelle Obama surface online in which she almost looks attractive. So...
Right.
I'm just shocked because, you know, I'm familiar with some of Cooper's other work regarding the submarines. That, you know, there's no question about it. He's very articulate, intelligent, passionate. He knows his stuff about the German submarine warfare. You know, I'm not going to speculate why he went that route, but to put that picture on the back of the book, it's an absolute joke.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of those kinds of pictures, you know, emerge or said to prove this, that, and the other. But, you know, has anybody managed to actually get to the source of what these images, where they came from?
Well, no. Anybody can put together an image. And now, this I'm speculating a little bit, and it's not really important. But I did find an image of an actor called Bruno Ganz, who portrayed Hitler in a 2004 movie called Downfall.
Yeah, I've seen that one. Yeah, the German movie.
Yeah, and I have the image of Ganz and the image of this supposedly elderly Hitler side by side. And doggone it, if they don't look like dead ringers from the nose down, I really believe that this is an image of Ganz that was slightly altered. You know, if you look at it side by side, so that's how it surfaced online. Maybe it's not Bruno Ganz, but it certainly does look like it to me.
Yeah,
but whether it is or it isn't, I mean, you see it?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. You're right, of course. There's even a little kind of a cut or mark on the tip of the chin that almost looks the same and whatnot, but the sloping of the mouth and all that. But I guess the point there is, if you had the opportunity to photograph a, you know, Hitler like that, why not kind of lift off the scarf there, you know?
Yeah.
Or, okay, yeah. Sure, anything could happen, right, that we don't know. That we're in a tremendous hurry. There was something, you know, who knows, right? And it could be possible, but it's one of those kind of, it's a kind of a red flag that they didn't do it right, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's, hey, boss, why do you have a bandana on your head?
Yeah, exactly.
If he's trying to conceal his eyes, why even wear anything? Why even be photographed at all?
Right.
But that's the word there that just really struck me. Surfaced online. You know, as they would say in a courtroom, Your Honor, I move to dismiss. And any judge would dismiss, certainly. So then that brings us down, and I summarize this neatly in a chart. I have suicide theory in one column, Argentina theory in the other. And then on the side, I have witness evidence, documentary evidence, forensic evidence. For the suicide theory, yes, yes, and yes. For the Argentina theory, no, no, and no. So the whole thing is just based on a couple ambiguous statements made by the Soviets. Oh, and one other thing, a lot of importance has been attached to a few comments that were supposedly made by Eisenhower and Truman, expressing maybe some ambiguity as to whether or not Hitler died in Berlin. And I point out that doesn't prove anything, because they had to rely completely on whatever Stalin was telling them, you see?
Right.
So as far as for these one-liners attributed to Eisenhower and Truman, they were not present in the bunker, neither on the day of the suicide nor in the days after. So everything comes to them from Stalin.
Yeah.
So what does it matter what they say? So again, that does not impress me. And then finally, I point out that all of these authors, when challenged, they fall back on the negative proof fallacy. In other words, prove me wrong. Okay?
Right.
You know, Cooper writes in his book about, it was a critic who really attacked him. And he writes, he, meaning the critic, goes on point by point, attempting to show that the book is incorrect. Well, we did not include the whole letter because it goes on page for page. None of it proving his point that this book is wrong. Jerome Corsi, in his book himself, writes, where is the proof that Hitler didn't escape? I mean, this is logic 101. I mean, I can say, hey, Henrik, prove to me that you didn't steal a tube of toothpaste last week.
Right, right.
What are you going to say?
Yeah.
You know? And it just goes on and on. I could have written a whole book on this. So I don't know what the motives are, but it doesn't really matter. The point is, this hoax is starting to catch on, and especially with a big name like Corsi now coming up with a book. And I just wanted to do my best to kill the myth once and for all. So I would definitely encourage your readers to have a look. TomatoBubble.com. Go to the update section. Look for Hitler in Argentina hoax.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to have it linked up, of course, so people can go through it themselves and see what you make of it, and, you know, go through the other material as well. And you know, if that's a passion to figure out what happened here, definitely look at this, because it's very interesting. And I think it piggybacks on this issue that, as you said before, there was a lot of you know, German soldiers that did go to South America. We know about the rat lines, etc. There, I mean, these things were established, right? So it's easy to kind of get, you know, carried away here. Is there anything you want to mention into, I don't know how much you've looked into that, but in terms of, you know, who actually did get to Argentina, was there anything in terms of an established network in place in South America? There are allegedly some of those towns and all that. I guess one question I posed was like, well, you know, why didn't, like, you know, Simon Wiesenthal or someone go after him then if he went over there or something, right?
Yeah, and that's another thing. That flies in the face of everything we know about our dear Zionist Marxist Jewish friends. The idea that they would just allow this to, you know, go on and say, well, just let him stay there. He's out of our hair. Even if it was in their own interests to do so, they wouldn't be able to help themselves to go down there and abduct him or kill him like they did to Adolf Eichmann, you know?
Actually, that was a question I wanted to pose to you as well. I mean, I know it's kind of just pointless to extent to kind of just, you know, contemplate these things, I guess. But, you know, nonetheless, just for the heck of it, what do you think would have happened if, let's say, you know, Hitler didn't commit suicide? He would have been captured in some capacity. Again, because we're back to the trial stuff. I mean, but it doesn't mean that a trial will reveal anything, as we saw with the farce at the tribunal there in Nuremberg with Eichmann and all that, right? So,
yeah, well, Eichmann was kidnapped years later from Argentina, brought back to Israel and killed. Nuremberg happened in what, 46 or 47? You're asking what would have happened if they captured him?
Yeah.
If they would have tried him in Nuremberg, yeah, I don't think they would have killed him like Mussolini. I think, well, then again, I don't know, because, you know, you can just imagine the show he would have put on and what he would have dumped into the historical record.
Yeah.
So maybe they would have done a Mussolini on him. I don't know.
Well, that's just it. It's like Saddam or Gaddafi, if you think about what happened there, right? It was easier to, you know, let the wolf pack have him as opposed to actually bring him in, right? And actually let them speak about their story and what happened. That's why they never do that, you know?
Yeah, well, they, I mean, the big name that they did get was Goebbels. Not Goebbels, Goring. But the one thing in Nuremberg that they did not try, or they really didn't get into, and this is deliberately, of course, was the causes of the war. And the chief American prosecutor or persecutor at Nuremberg actually wrote back to Harry Truman before the Nuremberg trial started, saying that, you know, they have interviewed all of the Germans, and they all believe to a man that the war was imposed upon them.
Yeah.
And therefore, I don't think we want to get into that and put all that in the historical record. So they took the approach of, okay, you guys are guilty. We just want to find out who knew what and when they knew it and who's going to hang and who's going to go to jail. And we'll even let a couple guys free, you know? So that's how that went down. They deliberately steered the case away from the discussion of any type of culpability or who was responsible or what did Poland do and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. And exactly, glad you corrected me there. I obviously talked to, confused the names. Eichmann went to Jerusalem. That's where he did the trial, right? And he was, I mean, that was just, it's just amazing those things occur, of course, you know, but, and that there's no sensibility from the international community when these kinds of things happen. But we've seen a lot of that, you know, but let's just go back to that other question I posed earlier there in terms of, we left that out, I think, but Argentina, if there's any, was there any kind of network there in place, do you think? Is it something that has lived on in any capacity?
Oh, no, I don't think it lived on. I think any hopes that Argentina had of being quote-unquote fascist, you know, died with the demise of the military government in the 70s. I mean, I don't think it was anything more than maybe an organized effort to help some of these Germans escape. But certainly they weren't the ones coming into Argentina and you know, running the show. They just went out there to live out their lives. But, you know, it's always helpful to keep these Nazi boogeymen alive, you know?
Well, exactly. That's my point a little bit in a world. It's part of the frustration here, I guess, for me as well, that when you have such, immense fat pink elephants in the room, and someone is like, you know, trying to lift the rug to find a couple of dust specks to prove their point of who's running the world, you get kind of frustrated, you know. And yeah. And it's like a lot of this has been built on, you know, kind of rumors like the Red House report by Adam Libor and stuff like that. That, you know, yes, the Nazi network really lived on in Europe, right? It's actually the European Union, and they're trying to financially, you know, squeeze everyone out and stuff like that. And I was just like, wait a minute. It's like, if let's just think about the ideology for a bit of what they wanted to see, a strengthened Germany and these kinds of issues. What if that was the case? Why would we see what is happening in Europe today if they were still alive? If they had, you know, ethnicity of Germans in place, why would you see like just massive immigration into the country and just complete destruction of their own cultural, you know, heritage and the demonization that we see? This wouldn't happen, right?
It's ludicrous. But part of the motivation for some of this garbage, there's a reason for it. There are people in the alternative news, quote-unquote, conspiracy theory community who don't want to touch the whole Hitler thing or the World War II thing. It's too explosive. So they need a way to navigate around it. You know, what do we say? Okay, I got it. He was part of the New World Order.
Right.
But it was an internal power struggle, you say?
Yeah. yeah.
Because if you get into the truth, which is that this was the one man who beat the globalists, at least for a while anyway, it opens up a whole can of worms.
Yeah.
You start pulling on that thread, the whole fabric comes apart. And they don't want to go there because we have a lot of professional people in our community that, I don't know, they sell books or they rely on advertising. So they need to come up with a way to explain why the globalists fought World War II. So they make it sound like an internal conflict.
Yeah, it's just too shocking, right? Or the Rothschild sponsored him. There was something there that has to be going on, right? And it's just it's too much of a, it's too troubling. I think it's too emotional, but it's also too, just maybe to them dangerous. I've always been on the mind of just like, let's just look at the evidence and let's just see where it goes, you know? And it doesn't mean you have to, you know, side with it one way or whatever, but you know, whatever, just look at it and go with it and see what happens there. But a lot of people
don't. I've been doing, I don't know if you've noticed this, what I've been doing recently, Henrik, is digging up old issues of the New York Times and to use their own reports against them.
Oh, the letter. Tell us about that you posted. That was great. The letter that Hitler sent to the French prime minister at the time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the story of World War II is one day Hitler woke up. He said, it's time. I'm going into Poland. Well, I produce a letter that Hitler wrote to the prime minister of France, which, believe it or not, was printed word for word on the front page of the New York Times, the Jewish-owned anti-German New York Times. And you read this letter, which was, what, August 28th, I think? The war started September 1st. I mean, he's basically pleading with the French prime minister. I mean, the tone was polite, conciliatory, and so logical. Anyone who reads this cannot possibly say that, you know, this man is the aggressor. I mean, an aggressor is just going to invade. He's not going to take the time to write a love letter to the prime minister of France saying, come on, let's talk. We don't need to do this.
Yeah.
But I can no longer tolerate what the Poles are doing in Germany. But it's a very compelling letter, and I reproduce that at the website.
Yeah, you had some good notes to it as well, and actually analyze, you know, the reasoning and actually following the logic of what happened at the time and prove, you know, that this made sense and yes, he's actually right, you know. And it's like, and again, it's one of those things where it's like, oops, you know, you can't think like that, right? You can't agree with anything. It's one of those guilt by association things that whatever Adolf Hitler touched or said, it has to be the antithesis of everything that's right, correct? So, you know.
that's true. And he made so many excellent points in that piece. He renounced any claim to Alsace-Lorraine region, which, again, we're told, oh, he wanted that back from the French.
Yeah.
And I actually learned this from the letter. And I later confirmed it independently. But he writes in the letter that Germany built its defense fortifications and invested millions of marks. And I made the and this was outside of Alsace-Lorraine. In other words, they acknowledged the border. He renounced Alsace-Lorraine, and he built his fortifications in his own territory. I make the analogy to suppose you and I are next-door neighbors, okay? And I build a fence in my yard. Well, that is an acknowledgement that whatever's on the other side of the fence is yours, you see?
Mm.
And that's the logical point that Hitler made. But it is a powerful letter. It cannot be refuted.
Yeah.
It was ignored, and the Poles continued their escalation, knowing full well that the British and the French claimed that they were going to have their back. And I did a whole piece on that, which you posted on Marshall Smigley,
yeah.
How that went down.
Yeah, that was also a really, really good one as well. But it's just amazing that so many things are still to this day, you know, hidden about this. What some people I've lately heard refer to as the second European Civil War, because that's really, really what it was, you know, and the way that this went down. And it's just such a travesty, and it's such a shame that more people don't look at the evidence and the data and what it says or what they were thinking at the time. And again, I mean, I've said this many times, but I think it's worth repeating. But I think one of the reasons maybe even why the New York Times published this letter straight up is because the version that we're getting today, the fabricated version of, you know, what the Nazis wanted or whatever, that wasn't in place at that time. So at that stage, he was just another politician, and there was no reason to censor him or see anything different about him. See, that's another clue to that there's this huge fabrication of the image of what they were and what they wanted that's been constructed afterwards.
Right. Well, let me explain why a Jewish-owned anti-German New York Times would publish such a letter. It's because in order to maintain a veneer of credibility, you have to present some degree of the other side. And the game that the New York Times used to play then, and they're still doing now with Russia, of course, but the game they used to play is they would give you 4 or 5 anti-German pieces, okay, and then slip one that could be considered the truth. And in that way, they're able to manipulate their audience, because they're attaching more weight to one point of view over the other, yet at the same time, they can claim, hey, we get both sides. So therein lies the deception. And that's the project that I'm undertaking now, is to dig out these nuggets of truth. And when people ask me, gee, why would the Times support Hitler like that? No, they're not. All they're doing is giving you a little truth just to protect the illusion of objectivity.
Right.
But there's a lot of diamonds in there. I make the metaphor to digging for diamonds in a cesspool.
Yeah.
I just found another one regarding the invasion of Belgium and Holland. I'm not going to give that away, but that'll probably be coming out in the upcoming week.
Oh,
so
great.
I'm having a lot of fun digging through these old New York Times and using the enemy to make my case.
Well, that's great. Do they have like a good search function so you actually, find the stuff you're looking for, or do you have to go through it issue by issue or something like that?
Well, you pick the date, and you can find out what's on the headlines. And what I'm doing is I'm looking at some of the major events that went down throughout history, and then I'll target 1, 2, or 3 days later the issue and just kind of peruse the front page. So that's how I'm able to find some of this stuff. And then when I have time, I'll just like look at random. I mean, I don't have to go through the whole paper. I'll just go through the front page and I'll see if I can pick up, a little clue of something that is true that they were compelled to report at that time, and I can resurrect it. But now that years have passed, they've killed all of that entirely in terms of the history books.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's I wonder if there's anything that has been censored from these archives and whatnot, because, I mean, it's really great, of course, to have these kinds of archives at our disposal. I mean, no one in the 60s could, well, maybe there's still archives you can go through, but in the capacity that we can do it today from online and just, subscribing to a server, it's just amazing in that regard. So that's great. It means that we can actually build a case even by the potential misrepresentation, but due to the fact that they've reported on stuff that happened and proved them wrong with that,
No, and I don't see any Orwellian censorship Because, I mean, how many people are going to dig through the old sold stuff? You know, maybe one day when Tomato Bubble has a billion readers, they might start dumping the old stuff. But this is authentic, and they actually present the image of the paper, and then they have a PDF attached that you can download of the actual article. And it's just astonishing, some of the stuff I'm finding. And to make an analogy, if you look today, for instance, the New York Times, and they're reporting on Russia, again, it's 5-1 negative.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, you'll pick out an article that gives the Russian point of view. Okay? Again, they have to in order to appear objective. And then 30, 40 years from now, if events transpire the way they planned, you'll never hear about those articles again, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The archive. That's the game, and I'm able to beat them at their own game. And keep an eye on my site. I'm gonna be digging these things up. And they, as you can see with that letter to the French Prime Minister, it's astonishing stuff.
Well, exactly. Great job on that, by the way. It's definitely what's needed and necessary to kind of help to break the lies around that. And as you write on the website as well, you won't see any of that on the History Channel or in a Ken Burns PBS crocumentary. So well done.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, give us some details again, by the way. Of course, we know the website, tomatobubble.com, but tell us about some of the other things you have. A couple of paperbacks available. I guess the Bad War as well. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, The Bad War is my book on World War II. You know, if you go right to the homepage, scroll down a bit, you'll see three main categories. I have the site very well organized. One is recent updates, which maybe 3 or 4 a week I add on. And then once they get older, I move them into archived classics. And that's broken down into categories: history, World War II, Russia, Putin, culture war, war on whites, etc. And then finally, there's PDF and paperback books that are available for sale. And I have 5 of them. The Bad War, NWO Forbidden History, which covers 250 years of conspiratorial history. I have The God of Logic, which is a challenge to Darwinism. And then I have my personal favorite, which is Hitler Visits Oprah, that you once posted on your site.
Yeah.
That's my favorite. It's whimsical. It's a long interview with Oprah Winfrey in which Hitler tells his side of the story. In the beginning, the audience is cursing and throwing things at him. And at the end, he's won them over with his logic and his explanation of the true events. And then, of course, I have a book on Putin, too. But it's all broken down. It's definitely a site that you want to bookmark. It's growing fast. And again, you know, there's no other niche like it because it's made idiot-proof. It's not simplistic, but it's simple.
All right, very good. Well, thank you, Mike. Good to have you back again. Do keep up the good work, and we'll have to have you back again as you find out more and dig through those archives. So thanks again, Mike.
It's a pleasure.
And that concludes our second hour for today, folks. We're going to be back in just a few days with more. We have a Radio 314 up next. And then on Red Ice Radio, we have Kerry Bolton, followed by Christopher Vassy, Marianne Van Court, Robert Ferguson, Jeff Gates, and many more. You have our list of upcoming guests in our radio archives on the websites. For now, we say thank you for being a member, and my thanks to the team as well. Have a great rest of your day, and please have a pleasant and productive week as well. And we'll speak to you soon. Take care.